Okay, after a week away, we are back to talk to you and with you. This is Soft Revolution, the podcast. My name is Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moment.
And this week on the pod, you guys, we have a great, great guest. We have the artistic director of the Factory Theatre here in Toronto. Her name is Nina Lee Aquino. She's been a leader in the Toronto theatre world for some time now and has seen the theatre through this dreadful year. And Ali, I was not around to have this interview because I had some family stuff going on last week. But Ali talked to Nina last week, and we are going to play that interview for you today. Ali, how was that chat? Did you guys have a good talk?
Oh, it was. I don't know. Nina was on fire. She's always effervescent, and she's just so intelligent and bright and just creative. And yeah, she's like a little firecracker, you know. So we spoke about, you know, because she first started out artistic director of Fujin, which was the first just Asian theater company in Toronto. And that's where they created Banana Boys. And she talked about just now compared to then. We talked about the future of theater, how, you know, digital is going to be incorporated going forward. And it's pretty cool stuff. And also an interesting thing about, you know, that theater should not be an event. It's just a thing.
It is just a thing. It should just be part of life. And I mean, that opens up a huge can of worms, because I think we'll talk about this further in a few minutes. But one of the things I wanted to address with you today was what I'm seeing is that, you know, even in the States, as you said a few weeks ago, yes, Broadway's coming back. Savion Glover and Nathan Lane just gave a concert, which was the first Broadway show in a year to a socially distanced audience. They are talking about plans to get Broadway back up, but you're seeing real change and real return happening quickly in the for-profit world. You're seeing it in the rock and roll world, tours being announced. You're seeing it on Broadway. The question is, how does an art form that lost money habitually, perennially, as part of its existence, how does that art form, namely not-for-profit theater, return from a place like this? I think it's going to be a long, bumpy, and possibly totally revolutionary and amazing road if we approach it right. But let's get into more of that later. First, before we do the news, Ali, I have engendered response, which is, you know, the people who love me would say, yes, Torquil, I often want to respond to him. And I use that word politely. We've had some viewer mail, and we want to share it because we love getting your feedback, you guys. We're very appreciative whenever somebody reaches out and lets us know their thoughts about the pod and what they're thinking about. It makes us happy. So, Ali, what have we got in the mailbag this week?
Yeah, so first, they come to me because you're elusive on social media. Sometimes you tweet from Soft Revolution. Sometimes you tweet from Stars. Sometimes your account is up, but then it goes away. You're the wind. You're like the wind.
I'm not controlled by these people. Yeah. I do what I want. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I'm like the Unabomber. I just sort of send missives out.
You're not that. No, you're nothing like that. Nothing.
I look like the Unabomber. You're
taller. You're taller than he is.
If the Unabomber shaved his head, he'd look like me. Let's put it that way.
Oh, Lord of mercy. Okay, here we go. So the first bit of listener mail we have from our friend Dylan. And Dylan is actually an indie artist, a band called Field Guide. And Field Guide is actually doing very well. You know, they're being featured on a Spotify playlist. And he's doing all right. So he wrote us and he goes, look, I have two things to talk about. And I want Torque's response. The first one is Spotify.
Yeah, I read this. But read it for the folks, because this is interesting. Yeah.
So the first one is Spotify. He goes, look, there is no doubt that there are some significant problems with the way Spotify is currently operating. Your conversation with Tom Gray was great. The fact that passive playlist streams are seen as equal to the hundreds of streams I rack up every month when I listen to either Leif Volbeck or my current favorite band, Slow Spirit, it's nuts. That said, I released an EP in spring of 2020 through a small Winnipeg-based label called Birthday Cake. Great name. And one of the songs has been and continues to be heavily playlisted, resulting in a steady influx of fans from all over the world, as well as approximately $1,000 passive income per month. For me, that's a big deal. It's pushed my career ahead, and it happened without a big fancy label, radio tracker, etc. Our budget for the single release was $300. I've been picking the brains of multiple high-end Canadian artist managers, and all are stressing that Spotify, streaming in general, but frankly Spotify is Google and everyone else is Ask Jeeves, that's pretty clever, is not going away. And it's quite likely that the pay will increase at some point, resulting in a game-changing ability for so many artists to make a middle-class income without having to leave home. In fact, for a lot of artists, that's already happening. Anyway, I realize that my experience is lucky and many of my friends have been left behind by Spotify, but I do think that the conversation is wider than Spotify is evil. Now, him and I kept on talking again, and there's one other thing that he did bring up. He said that if you're an established artist, it's actually, this has been very disruptive because you were living in one model and now you have to go back to another model, and it sucks. And really the way the system works is if you have songs on playlists. Because right now, the way people operate is, especially Spotify, I had a debate with my friend over Apple Music and Spotify. Apple Music is a lot better if you want to, like, you know, collate a bunch of albums and stuff and make a collection. Spotify is a disaster.
It also pays much better royalties.
Yeah. But Spotify really wants you to just add playlists and just press play. So if that's the case, if you're like a new artist and you get constantly featured on these playlists, sometimes I'll probably listen to Field Guide, not even know I'm listening to Field Guide, because I listen to some of those indie chill playlists.
Yep.
And he says, so, for people like us, it's better. So what do you think, Torque?
So what you got? Here's what I think. I think that Dylan is pointing something out that works about Spotify. And I'm really happy that it's working for him. I would posit that $1,000 of passive income when you're seeing hundreds of thousands of spins a month is a ludicrously small amount for Dylan to be making. I'm glad that it's something, and I know he's glad that it's something, but it's not enough. It's not fair remuneration for the property, the intellectual property that he has put up online. But I think that it's not... That two things can be true at once, right? That Spotify can have gotten something right about how a micro indie group or person might ascend and move through the ranks using the playlisting system on Spotify. Because what playlists do, right, is they open you up to a vast audience who never would have heard of you before. And only a small, small proportion of those people actually look to see who's playing in the background when they're studying or working store or whatever. But that small group of people might become Field Guide fans, and then they might follow Field Guide on Spotify. And so suddenly you've made a relationship with a listener, and that's fantastic. And I'm really glad to hear that's working for him. And it has worked for others. There's a guy called Donovan Woods, who's a great songwriter here in Canada, who got a lot of love on playlists on Spotify. And it was very career changing for him. And he picked up a lot of not just casual fans, but people who continued to follow his work even off playlists. The problem is that I am not as certain as Dylan that there will come a time when Spotify looks at their model and says, okay, now it's time to enable artists to make a middle-class living on this website, because their economic model depends on paying royalties so small that no one will ever be able to ascend to a middle-class life with Spotify playlisting.
They're a publicly traded company too. Their stock price needs to go up. They need to show more profit
and revenue.
And
like all publicly traded companies, they have an obligation most of all to their shareholders, and their shareholders as a collective are sociopaths. I mean, that is what the corporation is, right? It allows all of us to be immoral and allows all of us to make choices that as individuals we don't want to be responsible for, but as a collective of shareholders, we say, well, that's what's good for the company, so that's what we'll do. I think that there is absolutely nothing wrong with pointing out what's working about Spotify. In fact, I think it's important because it only accentuates what isn't. I would love to talk to Dylan after he puts out a few more albums about whether or not he's seeing that return that he expects from Spotify growing into an actual living wage for him. $1,000 a month is great. It certainly helps pay the rent, but it's not going to let him quit his day job or not have any other job to do, right? And so there is this vast, vast, vast group of people on Spotify like Dylan who are serious musicians, professional musicians making music, who are not actually, and have a hit. They get on a playlist, people like it, suddenly hundreds of thousands of people are checking him out. $1,000 is not enough. And so, I think two things can be true at once. I don't think that there's any going back from Spotify. There's no going back from streaming. Streaming is here to stay. It's not going to change. There's generations of people now who've grown up experiencing think of music that way. And for better pop music, pop has always been, to some degree, disposable, and it's certainly always been incredibly quick to change formats. I mean, in the space of 50 years, you went from, you know, 78s to 45 singles, to the vinyl album, to the cassette player, to the 8-track tape, to the CD, to the DVR. We have gone through so many technological changes in music, and that's going to continue to happen. So the question is, as Tom Gray put it, how do we get Spotify and others to adapt a user-centric model where people like Dylan are paid fairly for the amount of times their song is played? In good news, SoundCloud, I'll talk about soundscapes though, that's a sad story. SoundCloud has switched to a user-centric model starting last week. And that's really big news. And if that is a success for SoundCloud and it looks like it's working for them, I expect that to move into other streaming services. But Spotify has shown itself over and over and over again to be the very last adapter to any kind of change in terms of seeking fairness in the music industry. And so I wouldn't say that Spotify, the people who work at Spotify in and of themselves are evil, but I would maintain that any corporation that that has that much control over a market share and has that much say over the way in which things are platformed cannot help but be inherently destructive, because it's not there, in fact, to advance the careers of the people it's exploiting. It's there to advance the wealth of its shareholders. And so it's an agree disagree with Dylan. You know, I get what he's saying, but I still think that it ain't working right now. It's not working for the vast majority of musicians, and we have to find a better way to get people paid fairly by Spotify. But thank you, Dylan, for writing, and I'm gonna go listen to your band now. I like the name,
man. That's a good name. Yeah, it's great.
I'm gonna check it out. Maybe we'll rock some field guide at the end of the episode.
Yeah, you know what? Maybe we will.
I think we'll do that.
There's another thing he wrote that's quite interesting. He goes, "Look, this is about government support. I realize that things would be different if I had kids or a mortgage." Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Freaking kids and a mortgage. Life changing, bro. And it was later on in my career, but I have to say, most of my peers are in a much better financial position now than they were pre-pandemic.
Yes.
$2,000 a month, right? $2,000 a month with some ability to make a little bit of extra money here and there as sessions and some shows return. I haven't had that kind of stability since being a full-time artist. Plus, I've seen multiple small business grants from the Manitoba government, top-ups from Factor, and new programs from CCA and Manitoba Film and Music. Look, none of this is perfect, and there are absolutely people who are being left behind, and that has to be addressed. But guys, imagine if Stephen Harper was in power right now. Yo, this guy is a liberal field guide. Come call me. I'll get you in the party. That's sends shivers down my spine. Can we not give some credit when credit is due? I don't think JT has abandoned the cultural industry completely. Factor just announced $100,000 for grants for artists, promoters, managers, labels to offset the cost of getting back on the road in the next 12 months. Sometimes, and this is, I think, his main point, sometimes I worry that not acknowledging these things will push leaders to give up next time if our industry is so impossible to please. Anyways, just some thoughts.
All fair point.
Y'all great.
All fair
points. I love you.
I think this is very, very important, the point that Dylan made about the fact that he feels more economically secure than he ever has. That was something that came up earlier in the pandemic, that they had started to do research, and a lot of people working in the arts in Canada suddenly had more money in the bank and more stability than they'd ever had in their career. And yes, the Liberal government deserves credit for that 100%. I will say it's a minority government, and were it not for the NDP pressuring them to extend the CERB would not have been extended. And so what I think you can say that there's credit to be passed around amongst two parties, certainly not three. And I absolutely agree with Dylan that if Stephen Harper had been in power, we would be truly hooped right now. Or if any conservative government had been in power, we would be truly hooped right now. But I disagree that continuing to ask more and continuing to demand that we be treated fairly in terms of our commitment and our contribution to this economy is not going to turn any politicians off. I think public pressure helped secure the CERB. It helped secure those fundings for the Canada Council, for the Ontario Arts Council, and for Factor. I think that if we had sat quietly, that would not have happened, because believe me, they are, you know, getting requests from every single special interest group in society. society. It's not just artists who are suffering, right? It's, you name it, they're suffering, other than Amazon, basically. So everyone wants money. And I think the squeaky wheel got the grease in this case. And I would continue to point out to Dylan that we are not getting money commensurate to our contribution to society, that art creates more wealth than it spends, that we create more jobs than it takes to fund those jobs, and that we are a positive in society to the tune of 3% of our GDP. That is a vast amount. It's bigger than the forestry industry, you guys. We got a lot of trees, but we got even more great cultural stuff to export and to use. And so, you know, this is always the question, especially in Canada, is should we be nice or should we make a fuss? I think in the progressive movement, this is what I'm hoping, is that we realize there's room for all of us. And it's important to have street fighters. It's important to have people who are going to push people to the very, very furthest they can go. And it's important to have consolidators. It's important to have pragmatic people who are willing to compromise and are willing to acknowledge progress when it's
you
been made.
You need the torque and the alley.
You need torque and alley. You need Starsky and Hutch. You need Charlie Brown and Lucy. You can't just have one
or
the other.
Who's Lucy here?
Maybe Jen Lena's Lucy. She intellectually pulls the football out from underneath our feet whenever we think we're going to kick it.
He does make a really good point. Listen, I don't want to say that politicians are like puppies, but just like how I am with, you know, little baby Rumi, my puppy over there, when he does something bad, I scold him. When he does something good, he gets a treat.
No, I 100% agree.
You know,
I 100%
we do because especially now with this media ecosystem, you know, we had Jen Ag on a couple weeks ago, and then I was talking to an MP and telling him, like, hey, you know what? She was actually speaking very highly of the government, the federal government support in respect to restaurants, 65% for her rent, 80% on the wage subsidy, and then CERB and CRB for her employees when it's shut down. And she goes, you know what? I feel the government's doing great. They're like, can you send me that clip? Because they need to hear sometimes that this thing that they're doing is good, because it actually, positive reinforcement is also a thing.
I 100% agree. And I think if you noticed my Twitter feed, you would have noticed over the years that I do take the time when politicians do the right thing, it is super important to take the time to let them know that you appreciate it, no matter what party they're from, no matter who's in power. If Doug Ford made the right moves, you should let Doug Ford, if he ever should make the right move, which seems highly unlikely at this point, but if he ever does, you should let him know, because I agree that positive reinforcement's important, but also letting them know that things are simply not good enough is important as well. And making a fuss, and you see the consequences of being held to account right now in Ontario. A shutdown has just been called. They are now going to make that a stay-at-home order. They are now going to do all kinds of things that ER doctors got onto social media over the last week and demanded that they do. And if it weren't for the pressure applied by those doctors, well, yeah. But you know what I'm saying, that in the last week or so, in ICU doctors in Ontario have been on social media giving harrowing stories of what it's been like in their ICUs, the age of people coming in, the kind of sickness they're seeing. And without that kind of fuss being made, I'm not sure that the Conservative government would have taken the drastic actions that they're about to take in Ontario. So all great points, Dylan. Thank you for reaching out.
Dylan, thank you.
Those are important.
Thank you.
Who else we got?
Yeah, okay. We got mail? Yeah, we got, what was it yesterday? Curtis.
Our friend Curtis Duggan.
Yeah.
He said, I'm gonna paraphrase him, but he said that he hard agreed with me 77% of the time, and he hard disagreed.
Man.
Well, it's interesting, because some years ago, a friend of mine said, torque is right 82% of the time. And the other 18% is absolute errant nonsense. And I thought, God, that's really accurate. So 77 to 82, that's within the margin of error.
It's pretty close.
I think we can now say it's scientifically provable that I'm right 80% of the time.
Yeah, but then the other 20 is very hard.
Let's not think about the other 20, Allie. That's hard, not important. It's the... Anyway, Curtis had some great points to make about several things. Can you read those tweets to us?
He goes, I'm genuinely interested what you and your co-anchor, he calls you the co-anchor, thinks of the latest BC news and messaging around variant vigilance versus it's over. And then he wrote, I strongly agree with about 77 of what Torque says on the pod regarding COVID, and I've hard disagree to the thing. But then he also said what he agrees with is messaging could be so much better all around, including messages of hope. Permanent COVID fear and let's wear masks forever is unsustainable. Government should do more for cities, print money, help people. Taxation policy should permanently change to help the vulnerable. This is where he disagrees. Here we are with the 23%. I think sanitation, theater, and being extra careful on safety is more helpful than Tork gives credit for. I hate to say it, but sweaty rock shows where, as we all know, people get inebriated and inhale, man, this sounds like fun, and exhale marijuana may have to be the last thing to come back.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's wrong there. There's no question that that's going to be extremely problematic getting people back into small sweaty rock clubs. I'm not sure I ever said otherwise. I wish it wasn't so, but I do agree with Curtis that the last things to come back are going to be that kind of rock show where you go into Lee's Palace or, you know, whatever, and you stand right next to somebody and you scream and yell and sing. I think this brings me to something that we've been talking about a lot, which is about messaging. And it kind of segues us into, I guess, the news, because it at least in Canada, it sure feels unbelievably scary right now and unbelievably confusing. I think that people really are at the end of their ropes, and that we are being asked to contain two radically different ideas, namely that we've never been in more danger and that we've never been closer to being out of danger. And that is like, those paradoxes are incredibly difficult for human beings to contain within their brains. And it's very difficult to message publicly. You know, look, I think that what we are seeing happen in Canada is pretty catastrophic. And I'm not talking about the medical crisis, which is catastrophic right now, because the medical crisis will be solved by these vaccines. These vaccines, you're seeing 98% reduction in cases in Israel. You're seeing massive drop-offs in Britain. These things are incredible. There are 8 cases in Ontario in long-term care today, Ali. 8 cases.
And there will probably be 0 deaths because of them if they've been vaccinated. Yeah.
Absolutely, unbelievably, amazingly effective medicine, right?
Yeah.
But why are we here? Why are we in this place of being one of the last countries on earth to come out of this thing, of finding ourselves in a third wave that felt like it was inevitable, that felt like everyone saw it coming, all the experts told us what was going to happen, politicians tried to play footsie with this thing and failed. And so now Ontario is going into lockdown, BC will probably go into lockdown, Quebec is extending its curfew, shutting down some areas of the province. You know, I was thinking about this, and it's funny because Pierre Trudeau's prime ministership kind of ushered in the modern era of how Canadians thought of themselves, namely as a pretty progressive place where, you know, we built the space arm, technology and medicine were at the forefront of our economy, that we were a research and resource-based economy, but that we also had a very cohesive culture based on the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and on our bilingual and multiracial background and multiculturalism as a policy, all these things. To some degree, all of that was a lie. That myth was a lie in the first place. But it was what kept this country in many ways over the last 30 years having a sense of identity. And it's ironic that Pierre Trudeau's son finds himself prime minister at the time when I think we are at the end of that mythology. That this pandemic has revealed that this country is not prepared for this. And it's not actually a place that can move quickly in response to change. It is a place of stasis. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the advantages of the parliamentary system over the last year. You and I have discussed how Canada, you know, Canada's moderation and Canada's ability to achieve consensus and our healthcare system and all those things were predicated on a parliamentary system. But now you see the disadvantages of that parliamentary system. Everything's strength is also its weakness. And so down south, you have a country that played fast and loose with this virus, where hundreds of thousands of people are dead, where they kind of said fuck it from the word go. But They have a strong executive branch and they are massively wealthy. And so when the time came for vaccines to be put in place, they had a huge manufacturing sector, they had tons of money, and they had a federal government with massive powers.
So you're
powers.
Saying capitalism came to the rescue there. I'm not trying to be like a thingy
I'm not,
thing.
I'm not
but,
saying
but don't
capitalism.
Forget.
I'm not saying capitalism came to the rescue. I'm saying
I'm talking about those businesses did.
I'm saying the federal government was able to move quickly enough to use capitalism to harness capitalism to get things done. Hey, Ali, we're a capitalist country.
Yeah,
and I
sure.
think that we have been kidding ourselves into thinking we are a European style social democracy. And we're not. And so we've responded to this pandemic as a European-style social democracy without any of the actual placeholders and any of the actual foundation of European-style social democracy, to the point where you see that in Toronto right now, 90% of the vaccines have been handed out in the richest neighborhoods in Toronto with the lowest rates of COVID-19, and very, very, very few vaccines have been handed out in racialized neighborhoods, in the poorest neighborhoods in Toronto, where there's the highest rates of COVID-19. That's
empathy
not a
deficit.
Canadian story.
Empathy
that is
deficit.
Not how we see ourselves, and yet it is the reality of this country. And so I think we are at a real inflection point. We are really at a point where we have to ask ourselves some hard questions about what this country wants to be. Do we want to be a US-style capitalist quote-unquote democracy? Because if we do, the parliamentary system and the powers of the provincial government are going to constantly be at odds with that system. Or do we want to be a genuine socialist democracy, a genuine European-style democracy, in which case we see a medical system that we have shortchanged and underfunded and cheated and not paid attention to for decades finally falling apart in the face of what is, relatively speaking, a pretty mild pandemic. So I think we got some difficult questions to ask ourselves here in Canada, and I don't think any of us should be particularly proud of the way this country has responded to this. And, you know, there's lots of blame to go around. As I've said, it's interesting. You see, in BC, we're screwed right now. Numbers are through the roof. People are angry. They don't feel that the government is responding properly. That's a left-wing NDP government. In Ontario, you have a right-wing, hardcore right-wing government. They are experiencing exactly the same thing. So neither government responded to this well. And it leads you to the question, is it in fact just our system that is deeply flawed when in response to crisis? Do we as a country, considering how much geographic space between us there is, how few people relative to the amount of space around us, and our language laws and all those things, do they hang us up and make us unable to act in a unified way when we really have to? You know, I should Justin Trudeau bring the army in? I kind of think he should, because I don't think Doug Ford's going to get this shit done. I really, really don't think he's going to get this done. So
it would turn into a disaster.
You'd have people in the streets saying, oh, my God, yeah. Justin Trudeau's trying to take over the country with a communist, you know. But that's what I mean, is we don't have the mechanism, really, that can deal with this. We can't set up federal vaccination sites without calling the Emergency Measures Act out. And the Emergency Measures Act out, calling that out, well, who was the last person to do that? Justin Trudeau's father.
Yeah.
Right? So, and people didn't like that very much.
Yeah.
So we're really, we're in a bad way in this country. And I think that there's a lot of self-reflection that we have to do moving forward. I suggest taxing the rich and investing in our healthcare and education systems and stop
pretending that we are a social democracy
when we're just the little brother of a capitalist sociopathic system.
Yeah, the 80-20 rule was hard there for me. You could have invested everything and its cousin into this public healthcare system. Everything and its cousin and its fourth kid. It wouldn't have fixed it. This is an issue of competence, creativity. If you look even in this country, you look at the Atlantic provinces. They made a creative decision. They said to themselves, we're going to have an Atlantic bubble. It had nothing to do with vaccine procurement. It had nothing to do with how many hospital beds we have. Maybe that is what like amplified their decision. They realized early on that this virus is airborne, asymptomatic, and exponential math. Those three things, only things that matter. And from there, they said, we're going to go COVID zero. Australia, same thing. New Zealand, same thing. The other countries, you know, Canada is where we are, and it's really shitty. But Germany's worse than us. Germany is worse than us. The UK is doing well because they went straight on vaccines and they had the AstraZeneca and the Oxford vaccine. But
well, and the Brexit people will tell you it was because they weren't part of the EU, right? So they didn't have to follow the EU regulations. And I think, you know, that was a bit of a victory for Boris Johnson. You got to hand it to him.
This isn't about political system. This is about competence. If we made a decision to have gone COVID zero in Ontario, or every province, if we would have done our version of an Atlantic bubble, if we would have had competent government, creative government, we would not be here. The truth is,
you're not going to find any disagreement from me there, buddy.
Yeah, it has. And look, I would love to throw money at everything and say, if we just throw money at this, it's going to do it. But you could, as I said, you could have everything and its cousin in the healthcare system. And yes, we need it. And the same goes for the education system. But if you still have people who aren't able to actually understand the problem in front of them and make a decision, I'm sitting here asking myself, what is going on with Doug Ford? What is happening in his brain? It doesn't. I'm actually not going saying, oh, you know, it's a parliamentary thing and it's a system and we cut this and this. Yes, definitely we need paid sick days, 100%. No ifs, ands, or buts. It's obvious. But I'm literally going, this isn't about policy. This isn't even about government. This is about what's inside these human beings' heads. How do you open up patios in Toronto and then come out and say, I can't believe the patios, you know, you saw how busy those patios were. How do you shut something down, leave the malls open, and then you see people at the malls and be surprised that people are at the malls and then admonish them? This is gaslighting 101, basically what he's doing. This is about what's in the people's heads, not what's in the House of Commons. This is an issue of competence. Now, what you do is you vote some better people in, and I think you realize that elections freaking matter. Soft Revolution is brought to you by Effin' Birds, a book and webcomic by our dear friend Aaron Reynolds. And as you know, it's not just a book, it's not just a webcomic, it's not just an amazing social media account that you should follow, damn you social media. But, you know, they also got playing cards. And for the past few weeks, I've been taking out a card and I've been describing it to you. So today, let's do it again. Here we go. Oh, I got the Joker again. No, we saw that. Next one. Awesome. Great. I got the Six of Spades and it's an owl and he's looking at me very lovingly and he's saying, fuck you. I'm hilarious. This is really good stuff. Listen, go to effinbirds.com, EFFINbirds.com. Grab the book, grab the webcomics, grab the cards, and then check them out on social media as well. Because you know what? You need it. Effinbirds.com. Thanks again for supporting Soft Revolution.
Yeah, and you know, we have so many, they have so many masters, right? They have masters, they have corporate overlords who contribute to their campaigns, who, the people who run the banks who are asking them to protect capitalism at all costs. They have, you know, social media barking at them, the latest, you know, an elderly friend of mine said the other day something beautiful, which I wanted to pass on, which is, I said, how are you doing right now? And because his son has COVID, totally fit guy, 50 marathon runner in the hospital with COVID, just crazy, like absolutely on his knees. And this guy who's a former doctor, a retired doctor and a former Olympian, an amazing guy, said, you know, right now we are living in the actual definition of pandemonium. This is a pandemic and people are in a state of pandemonium. There is rumor, there is conjecture, there are policies being reversed on a dime, there is uncertainty about everything. People are believing the worst inevitably, which is being forced upon them by a media that cannot stop its addiction to bad news and cannot stop using clickbait to make money. We should get to the interview, but I want to go over one quick thing with you before we do that in regards to that. But he said, you know, this is pandemonium. And the only thing to do in pandemonium is to stop and to breathe and to look around and try and see what's happening that is positive, because there is massively positive things happening around us that we just have to pay attention to right now in order to get us through the shitstorm that is also happening around us. And I myself, I think, have found that in the last week or so, this is the most afraid I've been of this disease since last March. Like, I am fully, my body and my mind and my emotional state is back to that kind of fight or flight response that I had early on in the pandemic. These variants are scary. We don't know how really they're spreading. They're spreading fast and they're getting to young people. And everyone is afraid. They're afraid to send their kids to school. They're afraid to go to work. They're afraid to ride the elevator with people. So in the midst of that pandemonium that we're all understandably in, I think that it would go a long way for all of us to stop and focus on that which is true as well, which is these vaccines are incredible and we are going to get out of this thing. Allie, before we get to Nina, let's talk briefly about a few exciting things that are happening in the world of performing arts. Weird but exciting things. The first one I want to talk about is, have you heard about this fog they've come up with, Allie?
No.
This hygienic fog?
No,
the New Amsterdam Theater in New York City was the setting last year for a two-week-long engineering assessment of the distribution and control of something called Grignard Pure through the theater's HVAC system. And the testing looked into how you could push aerosol-sized disinfectant through the air. I mean, this kind of falls into the category of what could possibly go wrong. You know, cut to 20 years later, theater goers all diagnosed with cancer, having inhaled a bunch of aerosolized mist that's supposed to cure them of COVID-19. But there are starting to be some kind of real attempts to adjust physically to what we're going to be looking at and financially over the next year or two in the live performing arts. Another thing I wanted to point out was that in Liverpool, the Everyman, the Playhouse, and the Royal Court, and the Unity, four theater companies in Liverpool are all selling tickets to each other's shows. This is a great idea.
Yeah, like, great idea.
Can we sell passports to Stratford and Shaw this summer? Can we sell a ticket that gets you into Soulpepper and Factory and, you know, any theater in Canada? I love this idea. I think it's a really cool way of allowing people to go to the shows that they feel safe going to in circumstances they feel safe going to them, and everybody benefiting, because we're going to rise or fall together. This ecosystem, this economic structure is going to rise and fall together. So the not-for-profit theater world is in a hell of a spot. We don't have an economic imperative to get back up. We're not going to be pushed by RBC Bank or anybody else. We're going to be pushed by the audience demanding to see it. And I think offering the audience as many incentives to come back as we possibly can get is a really smart play. Don't you think?
The government should buy tickets.
Yeah.
The government should buy a ton of tickets.
Love it.
At a subsidy. And then you should go to a site by the government, whether it's the Ontario government, they should do it. And what you do is you say, hey, I want to see a show and it's going to be a discount. And basically it's at like, I don't know, whatever, but it's much cheaper than if you were to go. But it's the same amount of money goes to the theater company or to the dance company or to the opera company or the museum, whatever. But you go on a government website to go and to like explore the province. That's what needs to happen too. But I think also while you're there, you are right. We should have cross promotion. Just like, you know, if someone comes on this podcast, we're looking for people who have a podcast, because people who listen to podcasts, our podcast, probably listen to other podcasts. So I think it's also important. I'm pretty sure that people who go to Shaw also go to Stratford. People who go to the COC also go to Opera Atelier. They go to they go to these things. So why are we with this like scarcity mindset? Let's believe in abundance. You know, let's cross promote. We're in this thing together. We ride or die together. This isn't a competition. But number one, government, please subsidize by hundreds of thousands of tickets. And then I want you to sell those tickets at a huge discount to the population. Get them back into these cultural institutions. That's
a great idea. Also, I wanted to share this piece of quite extraordinary news, which I don't think got enough attention at all in the news because, again, they are addicted to doom and gloom. And this is really, really big. In phase one trials, a vaccine against HIV has been found to be 97% effective in participants. Now, it's only the first stage of these trials. It's being done at the IAVI's Neutralizing Antibody Center in the Scripps Research Department. 97%, Allie. And the technology that has led to this is the same technology that Moderna developed to develop mRNA. The mRNA vaccine for COVID. So this pandemic might lead to millions and millions and millions of lives being saved in the future because of the enormous scientific leaps it's allowed people to take. And, you know, the thought of there being an AIDS vaccine, it's literally gives me chills, man, because even though in the first world we've decided the AIDS pandemic is over, it is not over. It still affects millions and millions of people a year all over the world. It's a horrible fucking way to die, and it's a horrible disease. And so getting a handle on this thing and finding hope in that is massive, and I think we should all celebrate that and think about that as a huge victory.
But wait, there's a lesson here. There's a lesson here.
Yeah.
And it actually pertains to climate change. A lot of people initially in respect to messenger RNA vaccines, they were like too crazy, too expensive. It costs too much. And right now we're even seeing it, you know, minus 70 degrees for Pfizer, minus 30 degrees for Moderna. So a lot of people say, forget it. But what we're realizing is that this is a wonder technology. There's something comparable, and that is the carbon capture. It's not enough for us to go to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. We also have to, because that's why it's called the greenhouse gas. It doesn't leave. It stays in the freaking atmosphere. So what we need to do is we need to capture a lot of this carbon. And there's a lot of technology that is being made, and the same kind of bullshit arguments are being made against it. You know, it's too expensive. It's too expensive. It's too expensive. Yeah, well, when something is too expensive, research, development to make it less expensive. I look at this iPhone that's sitting on my table here, right. You know, 20 years ago compared to what it is now, like that computer, first of all, didn't even exist. And if it existed, it would have been up like $1 billion. It's a crazy supercomputer in a room or something, right? Yeah. And now it's sitting on my desk. So we need to like realize that, you know, we have to invest in things like this. And we have to invest in the promise of things like this. When I read your favorite billionaire's book, Bill Gates' book about climate change, that was carbon. The chapter on carbon capture was the one where I said, oh, that smells like an mRNA vaccine. Mm. That smells like an mRNA vaccine. And right now it has a premium to use it, but that there's a premium means that governments need to really spend a lot of money in research and development. And that's how it goes. Because one day, like we're basically eliminating HIV, maybe we're going to kill some carbon, and that's going to be nice.
Let's hope.
Next.
Before we get to Nina, I got one more question for you, buddy. And I don't really know why I wanted to ask you this week. I think because I am seeing so much fracturing, because I do think that Broadway and big tours and those things are going to be back, especially in the States, sooner than I thought they would be. It's really looking like the Biden administration is doing a pretty extraordinary job of getting their people vaccinated. And it also seems like the city of New York have a bunch of innovative ideas about how to return culture to the city. Andrew Yang, you were mentioning, has a really cool idea that maybe you want to talk about a little. But my question to you was, for those of us who were losing money before this happened, in other words, for the world of not-for-profit theater, not-for-profit classical music, not-for-profit dance, where do you see those places a year from now?
I think there's an opportunity. I speak to a lot of small business owners, and they go, look, you know, the problems we are dealing with right now in respect to COVID, in a way, it's been an accelerant. You know, we have been dealing with Amazon. We have been dealing with that destroying our business. And now it really has just accelerated the inevitable. So I kind of think what we need to do, and I feel the same is probably going on with cultural institutions. They were like, look, it was shitty before, and now it's like absolute shit now. So I kind of think there is an opportunity and a possibility, because we have spent now over a year not engaged with each other, to be like, hey, a huge marketing campaign around let's get together. Let's get together. And a big push of like, this is what, you know, we all have missed. And there's no anti-COVID activity greater than experiencing culture. It is live culture, particularly. It is the most anti-COVID thing you can do. So I kind of feel there is a really huge opportunity, but it's going to require a cohesive effort by everybody, by industries together, not just companies, not just individual companies. Like everybody needs to get together in every single city and go for it, because there is a possibility. But at the same time, we need something like an arts and culture tax credit. We need subsidies. We need to like think about infrastructure that is both social and cultural. Those are also that is also what should be defined as infrastructure. We need like a huge push towards that. So, I mean, I'm quite hopeful. I kind of think we can revitalize cities if we have that spirit. I want the recovery to feel like a big block party. I want it to feel like a big freaking block party. So, but that's up
Here's
to us
to that.
If we want
Here's
it.
To that. Well, let's talk to somebody whose job it is to try and figure all this stuff out.
Yeah.
Nina Lena Kino is the artistic director of the Factory Theatre in Toronto. And Ali had the chance to catch up with her last week. And she's got some great ideas about what the future might look like in the world of art on Soft Revolution.
A lot of things. And I think what's so great about having you on is that, you know, we use the word intersectionality all the time. And you specifically, Nina Lee Aquino, are at the intersection of basically everything that's going on this year. You know, because not only are you the art. No, think about it. Not only are you the artistic director of Factory Theatre, so you had to deal with that. As like a theater artist, also as a mother who has a kid going to school, also as like having a partner, a husband who is also in the business. So it's like two people dealing with that. And then of course, you know, particularly now we have to deal with the fact of, you know, the rise in both the acts, which is despicable, but the awareness on anti-Asian violence. And you know, your first kind of artistic directorship was what? Fujin. Was
I
you
know,
said
right?
you know, an Asian specific oriented theater. So even back then, when did Fujin start? When would that happen?
Oh my God. When did I so Fujin was founded at around, I'd say unofficially 2002.
Wow.
And then we kind of came out to the world in 2004 with their first production of Banana Boys.
Wow. Famous
that,
production.
That really, yeah. And that really, for me, Banana Boys was the work that I think, you know, it's now a signature of Fujin, right? But the work itself really ushered in the next generation of Asian Canadian creators,
right.
Really, you know, and look at the cast, the OG cast of that was David Yee, Inserp Choi, Derek Kwan, Dale Yim, Richard Lee, right? All our careers, even though we were on different paths, like that really, you know, when that production exploded, it really kind of jump-started a lot of our careers in many
right,
ways.
Right, of course.
Despite the misconception, well, I'd say misconception, but like the reviews, it was just so different. Like that play was so ahead of its time. And that production, I would say, was so ahead of its time that even though hordes and hordes and hordes of, you know, like we remounted that thing for like 3.5 years for a reason, right?
Right.
Even though the reviews on that, and remember the reviewers back in the day were all hella white, except maybe for Glenn Sumi, just really misunderstood that piece so much.
Mm. What was some crazy stuff that they said? What was some stuff that in hindsight you go back, you're like, oh Lord of mercy.
Well, because the form of Banana Boys itself was not, you know, Norm Foster-esque, right? It's not A, B, C, D, E going to Z. Mm-hmm. It's nonlinear. Right? Mm. It's frenetic. It really captured that generation, like that MTV-like generation of like, it's like each it's five acts, first of all, right?
Mm.
Each centering on each of the boys, because Banana Boys was about, you know, five Asian Canadian bananas boys in particular, which again, at that time, and still now to this day, we know that Asian men are often disenfranchised, right? You know, so you had five sexy, unapologetic sexual beings on stage, like talking about being a banana. So white on the inside, yellow on the outside, and It's not chronological. It had kind of a sense of mysticism because the book dealt with kind of this mythical creature of the Chinese vampire. But at the same time, it talked about hockey and eating mac and cheese with chopsticks. So it was all of like, talk about
Canada,
a mashup
Toronto.
Of all. Exactly.
It's Toronto.
And the critics were just not used to it. Like they wanted the railroad worker. They wanted the grandfathers and grandmothers talking about the immigration. Like they just wanted a different container. Right. And I think they were really surprised at how in your face this play was. Right.
So yeah. Fujin started in 2002 and now here we are in 2021. Do you think if you were, let's say whatever age you were now, you're timeless. You never age to me, but let's say you were,
I'm proud. I'm 43 now going on 44, my friend. I wear that badge. Well, I can't wait till I get to 50 when I get to my Oprah years.
Oh, nice.
I'm one
Do
of
I
those.
Get a car? Do I get a car? You get a car. You get a car.
Listen, my career, Ali, has been defined by how young I look. I look young.
Right.
I do look fabulous. And that's genetics. Like I have a 70 plus year old mother who is often mistaken for like early 60s. Right. So
I
know. However, I will say that how young I look has often been a barrier.
And a woman and a minority. Trifecta.
Yeah,
you got the Holy Trinity.
I know. And I'm short too. I'm 4 foot 11.
Oh no.
So I've got a lot going against me when I walk into a room, especially when I am at the power position like a director. Oh my God. Like, you know, so I'm one of those that like I can't wait till I kind of look my age.
Right.
But maybe then I'll get a little bit more kind of respect, but I don't think so.
So anyways, let me ask you a question. Would you do now? Yeah. Would you start now? Do you feel like there is still something like a Fujin necessary right now? Even with the advances, even everyone, you know, everyone could like talk about, you know, you being artistic director of fact.
Yeah.
You know, there's Kim, although Kim's Convenience is also leaving. It's like, okay. But do you feel like there is still, you know what? We need another Fujin. A modern version. Like, would you, if you were at the age you were then, come out and say, yeah, I'm going to make another Fujin? Or is it about now we need to, like, get into the existing establishments? What's more effective? That's a good question.
I think all of them. All of them. I always say, like, there's space for all of this. Like, why not? Why not if there's a Fujin 2.0? Like, what is, I think it's all about reception, right? And I think that all stories are important. And if there is a new generation band of merry misfits that want to create for, you know, work by Asian Canadians for Asian Canadians, like, why the hell not? I think there's just space for all kinds of stories. We're a huge country.
Huge.
Therefore, the containers of the kinds of stories and who tells them, I think there's, like, I'd say go for it. You
right.
know?
So you're saying there is
there
space.
There doesn't have
there
to
space.
Be an owner. Yeah. Like,
like
why
we have nothing
there
has been solved yet. So keep going. There's definitely room.
Hells no. Nothing has. We're nowhere near. You know, we may take steps forward or steps to the side. So it feels like we're inching, but we are millimeters heading there. But it doesn't mean that I can't hope. You know, and it doesn't mean that the bricks that I am laying on the ground for the next generation is wasteful. It's just it's slow, you know, and change is hard for people in general. I just think that it's just hard to create your own theater company nowadays anyways, period. Mm. Whether it's an Asian specific one or not, like with the way our systems are built, the way that theater in general is such an undervalued entity in our society, you know, it's just hard to
why do you think that is? Why do you think that is? You know, because I'm somebody, I love history, and you go back and you really think about, particularly like post depression, theater was a way to like really create political justice, spiritual beauty. It was in the theater
absolutely.
That people would go and it would
right?
really advance society. Yeah, absolutely.
The theater
in New York and everything.
Yeah.
People just got together and they changed the world. So what happened? Because I think there is something about theater that is absolutely, you know, deeper and richer than film and television will ever be. because it's humans in front of you.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? That
yeah, absolutely. Feeling. And why do you think people are like, theater's dying? Well, it's like, well, we're still here, right? And if you think about it, if you go back to history, theater has been there like way even before what you've just talked about, like in the States. It's a form of community gathering, right?
Yeah.
In tribes, in, you know, and then when the, you know, if we look at in particularly the Greeks and how they use theater, mm-hmm. why Colosseums were built for theater, right?
Right.
Because it was, you know, like if you think about how performances were done in those Colosseums, why it was built for that, it's to maximize communication to mm-hmm. a large group of, you know, so I could just imagine like box office during the good old Greek days were through the roof, and why those structures were as big as they were, and actors needed to perform with megaphones, right? Like these cone-like structures so that every word can be heard, because every word that these playwrights back in the day wrote meant something, right? And it was meant to always enlighten, to transform, to make comment on. How that kind of eroded over the years, and now we're just quote-unquote an entertainment or a form to escape our problems.
Or elitist.
And the issues.
That's the thing. That's the thing that upsets me the most. That people who go to theater are somehow hoity-toity and elitist, and you know, above people. Yeah. When in fact, it's like theater is really the nitty-gritty.
Well, but you know, you can date that back to the Shakespearean times, right? Like, how did Queen Elizabeth, like with the commissions, these special commissions, right, to make these little plays for her? That's where you know, like that elitism kind of didn't start there, but that was definitely perpetuated, because only now a small group of people can see that. There was always the globe, there was always the people, but there were always these special. So, and then never mind opera, right? Like and the ballet, and how those, for some reason now, they are a form of kind of that back in the olden days kind of art form, right? Like even when I go to the opera, I still feel the need to dress up and still, you know, and look at the beautiful structures surrounding the kind of storytelling in those places. It screams of, like, you know, there's rules, unspoken rules when you go watch this kind of form of theater versus when you go to Factory. It's a dilapidated Victorian mansion that I love.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But you know, you come as you are. You're invited to kind of go in your jeans, your flip flops, and you know. But once those lights go down, make no mistake, like everybody's listening to the same damn story, right? And for that brief moment of time, like everybody is on the level, right? It's a great leveler.
This week at Crow's Theater, check out "Here We Are" by Aaron Shields. Here We Are is many things: a book, a play, an audio recording, and it can all be experienced for free at crowstheater.com. Governor General award-winning playwright Aaron Shields created Here We Are, an unstoppable outpouring of words, thoughts, and emotions to help make sense of the upheaval of the world she experienced over the past year. Featuring music by Thomas Ryder Payne and book design by Alfred Mulroy. Don't miss it. Is there an opportunity now? You know, we've all been cooped up at home for over a year, and I'm hearing from just the regular, I call them, you know, the muggles, you know, they're telling me that what they can't wait for is, I can't wait to go to a concert. I'm just waiting for someone to be like, I can't wait to go to the theater. But I do see the opportunity though, in that, you know, because we've been all cooped up, that we now have this thing that theater can make us sell. Do you see that? Do you think that theater can have a moment after the pandemic to say, look, you guys have been, you know, staring at your screens, and now it's time to stare at each other, and now it's time to get together again? Or do you think,
honestly,
no, we're going to be devastated even? Okay.
Select theaters. Only the perception, when you say theater, you think Mamma Mia, Miss Saigon.
You can say it comfortably. It's okay. You can say it.
you know, Phantom of the Opera, right? I won't even include Come From Away because at least that's Canadian. I can be proud of that one. But we're talking like, I think select theaters, absolutely, there will be a resurgence of that, like the Stratfords and the Shaws, because there's tourism attached to that, right? And again, when you say theater, that's what you think, like big, cushiony seats, spectacle, spectacle, spectacle. Right. But for the little guys, and even Factory is like a mid-sized theater company, we're really a blip. We're really a blip in like the society's minds, right? Like, you know, often I will get audience or patrons, new patrons kind of going, I never knew this existed.
Isn't that depressing? Like,
corner of Bathurst and Adelaide. Yeah. And I just, you know, and it's just sad that they think they have thought for the longest time that this theater isn't for them.
Well, right? You know, the thing I think about is that, you know, to rebuild cities in particular, culture is going to be, has to be, it probably won't be, unfortunately, because a lot of politicians, with the exception of me, of course, but with a lot of politicians don't understand the second, third, fourth order of culture. And I kind of hope that people realize that something like Factory Theater is a means to rebuild the economy of the city again. Because as we continue, and as, you know, more work from home continues, the raison d'etre of a city has to be defined not just by its physical infrastructure, but by its cultural infrastructure.
Well, because the cultural infrastructure is the soul,
is
right?
The soul. Is the reason we're here.
It's the soul.
Otherwise, like, let's go to Peterborough, baby. Let's do it.
Well, yeah. And that's why I feel like, you know, when I did my World Theater Message Day, when I was privileged to be the messenger for Canada, like, I just went right down to the heart of it, to the root of the thing of like that theater going should be a civic duty, right? Theater
going should be. How do we do that, though? How do we make it more accessible? Because it should be. And, you know, I have never met anybody who, you know, a lot of people ask me who are not in the theater. They go, hey, you know, I'm going on this date. What should I do? I'm like, take her to a play. Really? Take her to a play. You take her to a play? Unless, you know, if you take her to a play and she doesn't want a second date, it's you. She don't like you. So that's great. You could just move on.
Yeah.
You know, so why is that not there? What is it? Is it a marketing issue? Is it a ticket price issue? Is it an awareness issue? Is it a cultural issue? Like, what is it? Because I find with artists, we could be both specific and systemic. So what are the specific issues? And then what is a systemic issue?
I think it's an awareness issue and a cultural issue. I feel like Canada is really, really starved for culture and all kinds of culture. Like, I think that we, Canada right now, in the theater community, we're very much follow our American brothers and sisters, right? When it comes to kind of like theater, some European influences, but it's very much like we want to be the next Broadway. We want, you know, so why do we make, you know, Dundas, like look the way it does, right? And then the theaters that are surrounding that area are all the theaters with the high end tickets, again, with the most resources that can pretty up with the marquees, the lights. And yet, you know, the little gems, again, are, you know, in your neighborhood, and you don't know it, you don't want to know it. And, you know, going to theater is often made into, again, a special occasion or an event, and not like going to the gym, and not like going to your place of worship, or going
like
to
go
the market
see a movie.
On
just
Sundays.
Going to see a movie, like no big deal. Yeah, no. I'm going to the theater. And you know what? You know what's interesting? It's like, yeah, sometimes I went to the theater, or I went to this restaurant and the meal was amazing, and, you know, the meal was medium, but you still go back to a restaurant, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like watching a shitty movie and you still go back.
You still go back. I'm going to watch another movie. You know, you're not going to go, never going to see a movie again.
Yeah. For some reason with plays, there's quite like an unforgiving factor of like watching one play that you didn't like, and it's like, yeah, no, never again.
Don't
you know?
Find that when people come see something that they really love, this happened at Come From Away, this happens at plays that I've done, you'll always get, you know, the, I didn't know, I usually don't like plays. I usually don't like musicals. It's like, yeah, because it depends which play. It depends which musical. So just keep on going. Eventually you're going to learn. Eventually you're going to find a taste, and eventually you're going to appreciate it. So we got to get people going. So are there things that you've thought that, you know, government can do to help facilitate this. One of the things I'm thinking about is like an arts and culture tax credit, because I think it's important to give people money. You know, right now the budget, the Ontario budget was like, let's get people to go play, you know, kids to go play sports. Great. I think actually physical activity is amazing. And, you know, kids who are active and people who are active, that is better than any vitamin D pill. That is better than anything you can do for your immune system. So I'm all for it. Let's do it. But I also believe that we can give people a little something, something to go and engage in culture, because I find so much culture is like, we're going to give all this money out and it's important. Let's give the money out. But then people don't go see it. People don't touch it.
No. Nope.
Right?
No. Nope. So, unless it's imported from someplace.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And again, it becomes an event versus something that you actually need in your daily life.
That it's just a thing. Let's not make it an event. Let's just make it a thing.
We're going to go see a play. Like, and some European countries, this is like their way of life.
Broadway used to be like that too. Yeah.
Right?
Back in the day.
After, you know, you hop on the train or you hop on your bike and then you go see a theater and then you go to the pub and have a drink and talk about what you've just watched.
Are we responsible for that too? Because one of the things after this pandemic made me realize that perhaps we are too precious. And perhaps we're like, we treat this too much like a magic show, and we haven't, and we've bought into our own hype that what we're doing is really special.
That's why it's
work.
It's cultural and awareness. You know, to kind of take the mythical quality of theater that it's only like for special occasions. And so therefore the government then treats theater like it's a footnote as opposed to a pillar. Like, do you know what I mean? Like it's an attitude, right? And so if you think that culture is actually one of the pillars that holds society up, that holds a healthy society up, then you'd be given the proper attention and care in that pillar, right? What it's due. But if you think that like, okay, theater is non-essential, it's a footnote, then you're going to treat it like a footnote, that it's like, oh, only if there's a, you know, we get the scraps, we get like, so, and that's also an attitude shift, right? And
I love this
Like this pandemic has really kind of magnified that, and that, you know, I see those pictographs of like, you know, what are the essential workers and the non-essential workers, and arts workers are on the freaking top of the non-essential workers,
right?
Meaning nobody even recognizes our value, even when we were one of the most valuable things to keep our people alive. Mm-hmm. What the hell were you watching all this time during the pandemic? What, like, did you not read a book? Did you not listen to podcasts? Did you not binge watch on your television? Like, those things, again, were keeping you, like, sane and alive and healthy while you were cooped up in, you know, during the plague, like, to not even recognize the value and to be taken for granted. And that's a narrative that we've been dealing with even before times.
Right. But more than just like recognizing the value beyond the, oh my God, it's so special of like, but I think we need to start, talk to any restaurant, any shop, any store owner around a cultural institution. And it's not just the cultural institution that's hurting, it's everything around it. Like you shut, heaven forbid the Factory Theater shuts down. I mean, that's going to, I know there's a thriving, it's like, it's a cool area, but still, it's going to hit a lot of businesses. Talk to the Tarragon in Toronto St. Paul's. If Tarragon goes, forget about it. Just forget about it. Let me ask you a question about writers. And because they're used to, so I teach acting at George Brown. And, you know, we were talking
about.
I love the subtext. Basically, what Nina's saying is, thank God we're getting, you know, diverse voices in the teaching world. Yes.
Finally. Yes.
Finally. Okay. But so I was going through, you know, teaching them the method, right? You know, all the great teachers, Meisner, Strasberg, Adler. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we were also talking about the great writers that, you know, these young people don't know. Who's Arthur Miller? Mm-hmm. Who's Tennessee? Who are? And I will say this is interesting, that it seems that the most prolific writers at a time always wrote for the theater. And now, if you're a writer with immense talent, do you write for the theater, or do you write, just say, no matter how much I love the theater, I'm going to film and TV?
You write for film and TV.
And so what is your, do you have a pitch to somebody who aspires to be a theater writer? Because at this stage in the game, unless of course you write something like Come From Away, I mean, God love those people. But what is it? Like, what's your pitch to a theater writer?
My pitch has always been honest, right? Theater, currently right now in Canada, it still strides the line of in the belief that suffering and poverty is part of the artistry, which we know is not true.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. So often when young writers do come to me, I will give them the lay of the land in terms of the opportunities that they can access. Right? Theater companies that will welcome them, that I think they would be a good fit, and that they also need to do their own research to know the kinds of theater companies that they need to be aligned with, right? But I will give them everything from the funding, right? And I will always fight for them to like, please don't pay out, you know, but I'll also give them the talk about how part of the hustle of being a theater artist, whether you're a writer, actor, or whatever, is that that includes maybe a Joe job, a good paying Joe job, or yeah. two or three Joe jobs, because that's part of the hustle, and that there's no shame in that right now, currently, because theater artists cannot live, especially if you're a writer, you can't. You will starve, you will be malnourished, and you will die a malnourished artist. And you're doing me, somebody in a position of power, no favors by being not healthy, both mentally and spiritually and physically, right? So I will encourage them to look for a really good Joe job, not just please don't deprive yourself in your heart by settling for a really crappy Joe job, because that will also seep into your artistry.
Yeah, you have to be rested and energized and nourished.
Absolutely.
Go to sleep is the best acting advice I'll ever say. Get a good night's rest. Like, you'll be much better.
All of those seep into your artistry. Yeah. So I could tell if you're, you know, not happy in the other parts of your life, then your artistry is not going to thrive. It's not going to be rich. And then I will then encourage them to also seek other means of discovering other facets of themselves as artists.
Yeah.
So you're a writer, you want to be a writer, but if you want to take control of your artistry, then you gotta also find the skills to be able to maneuver and navigate your own kind of, you know, self-determination. So that means go learn how to produce. Right? Mm. Go learn how to write grants. Go learn how to, you know, so these kind of ways to self-determine. So it's just allowing them and giving them permission to be their own agents as well. Mm. So that they're not just waiting around, twiddling their thumbs, and really kind of allowing their careers to be dictated by somebody else, by even somebody like me, right? Because if you have a play that you think is ready to go and know, and all the theaters have shut their doors, put it on. You find a way to put it on, to get your voice out there. So that means producing your first fringe show, producing like, you know, your first summer work show, making sure that the artist that you're hiring, that you want to be part of this production, is paid properly, compensated, that you yourself is compensated properly, you know, then do it. Let's do it. Because that is just the way to determine your worth, right? That's not being dictated by the powers that be and by like theater companies that have shut the door in front of your face, right? So often there, you know, so it's three-pronged approach, and it's an honest and authentic approach. I'm pretty transparent when it comes to the pitfalls of, you know, what it is to be an artist right now in Canada, to be a theater artist in Canada. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're a BIPOC theater artist, like I lay all those, it's freaking hella hard, 10 times even harder if you're a woman
of color. Especially in the city. It's harder here. Yeah.
You know, but I am a believer. My job as an artistic director is to also inspire. As much as I lay down the reality, I am also like a driver of that reality. I do believe that you can break the rules and you know, turn things upside down and shake the status quo and all of that stuff. So part of that pitch will always be one of hope and one of kindness, right? And we all
that's the artist in you. That's what artists do. Yeah. No matter how tough we are,
but
we also
gonna lay it
idealism.
Down.
We gotta go. We'll lay it down, but we'll also lift you up. It's this beautiful, beautiful thing.
But being an artist here, especially in theater, it's all about, you know, this whole mentality of like, oh, the suffering will make your art better.
No.
Nope, not true. You know,
stop it. Yeah.
And so therefore, even at Factory right now, one of the biggest things that, you know, I'm super proud of that we've tried to lobby is for playwrights to finally be on payroll, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, write to live, live to write. And you don't need, you know, so it's small, but it's a beginning and hopefully other theaters will follow suit. Like the idea that, you know, I'm going to pay you a salary, a living wage, so that you can write, so that you can fulfill your manifest destiny. I mean, that's been a fantasy of mine since forever and a day. And finally, we're getting donors, angels is what I call it, that are finally seeing that, that realize like we don't have to suffer and live on the poverty line to create amazing work, that just because we are comfortable in our lives and nourished, doesn't mean that the art suffers, that there's no rigor, that there's no demand for excellence. Because for some reason, I don't know how or when it started that excellence equals like, oh yeah, you've come the hard way. Hey, like, you know, and that mentality too in the rehearsal halls of like not being kind and generous in the room equals being soft and being like airy fairy and flaky. And which I don't know why rigor and excellence cannot go hand in hand with generosity and kindness. Like I just,
right. Well, that's the thing about you. I mean, you working with you, you demand rigor, but you're also kind. Like the two things can exist. It's like, this isn't this either or thing. So
yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that was a great pitch. Yeah. So just, I want to ask you two more things. Number one, you've taken Factory's season and you've really gone the digital route. You have,
Did I really?
You did the digital pivot. You did what you had to do. And you know, you now also have like a podcast series of plays. The first one by our dear friend, Anusri Roy.
I know. Did you listen to it?
I did. It's not fantastic. Yet? Also, okay. The best part though, also was right off the top. You're like, I was like, who is this silky voice? Oh my God, it's Nina.
No, I have gotten so many comments about my podcast voice. And I'm like,
hopefully compliments.
No.
Yes. Only compliments.
Like people
yeah.
are like, do you do audiobooks? I'm like,
ASMR maybe?
No.
I was like, can I get the Nina Lena Aquino ASMR?
Man. Two words, dry mouth. Oh my God. I will never go into a recording session again like that because I realize how much of a dehydrated individual I am.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's why they give you an apple when you're doing an audiobook. They just
exactly.
give you sliced apples.
No, right. Man. No.
Let me ask you a question. So, how much of this digital stuff, let's say COVID is fini, how much of this digital stuff do you take with you? Do you say to yourself, I need to have a hybrid going forward? Every theater company needs to have both a digital and a real life world. Is this true?
Absolutely.
Or are you going to be like, no?
Absolutely.
Great.
Why not? Again, there is so much space. Why? I just don't understand this binary way of thinking, right? It's either or. And
love
for
it.
Me, to get this amazing opportunity in a time, in a very challenging and despairing time, to explore and play in this virtual playground, like, why the hell not? And like this season really afforded a Factory the opportunity to kind of learn new ways of storytelling that were groundbreaking to us. Like for our work to be able to reach audiences, not just across the city, across the country, across the world. You know, we got viewers from Australia, from Indonesia, right? For the first time checking out Canadian work. But it also
and imagine they vacation here to Toronto. Where are they going to go? They're going to go. Let's go see.
Exactly.
Let's go to the so that's
and,
great.
And, you know, and I got American companies contacting us and kind of going, "How did you do?" Like for the first time, we were a resource, right?
Wow.
And that's amazing. And then accessibility issues. Like, we had audience members that for the first time were able to see a play in the comfort of their own spaces because our building is not accessible at all at the moment. And of course, we're working to change that. But at the moment, like, to be able to kind of live stream and give them the feels of whatever this form that we were creating, the storytelling, and for them to kind of go, yeah, finally, I was able to see it. I was able to watch it and be part of a virtual community made them feel great. And then you couple that with a free season, right? Taking out that financial barrier, that's it. Like, audiences really, like, it's been amazing. It's been like so much learning. And so for me, post-pandemic, you bet we're gonna bring this into amazing. Because this should be part of the collection. You know, you can still do in person, why not? But why can't you also create like virtual productions that are just virtual? It's not even like, oh, let's stream our regular in-person productions. But like, if playwrights want to write to the medium of like a virtual platform, why not?
Yeah, you know? I'm a huge proponent of it. And also, I know you and I, and also your husband, Richard, we're a little geeky, you know? I tell Torque this all the time, and he's just like scared of all this stuff. And I'm like, no, embrace it. Because I always say, I go, look, Apple's coming out with glasses. And when they come out with those glasses, just you wait, Henry Higgins. That's going to be the beginning of the next frontier for artists, for particularly people who understand theater. Oh my goodness, the opportunities that are there. And you do make sense that the person who watches a digital show will all of a sudden go to the theater show. And the person who goes to the theater version of Factory Theater is going to touch the digital stuff. So it's
For some reason, there's this fear that we have of like when, and I think that's why we're so
it's because we want to be like, it's not theater.
To change.
It's not theater.
Well, but it's also kind of just a generalized fear of the idea of change. That just because something goes to the forefront, for some reason, we think by default, the other stuff that we have amassed and collected disappears.
Right.
And I'm like, there's space for everything, my friend. You know, it doesn't mean that we can't do the traditional with the new and the traditional. And somewhere in the middle, I'll be in the middle trying to mash up both. Right. Mm-hmm. And I just... it's not one or the other. And I really don't understand that general fear of change, that for some reason change is, it's not an isolating thing,
right?
You know, and it's the same fear of like hiring leaders of color. For some reason, there's this thing of like, okay, I'm going to step aside. I'm going to decenter myself and have other voices on top and just disappear. That's the narrative that I'm hearing. I'm like, what makes you think you're going to disappear just because I'm at the top?
Right.
Like the fears projected on us, all of a sudden, you know, decentering doesn't mean disappearing.
Nina, you're asking for spiritual, these are big spiritual things. Like one of the big reasons we suffer is change. Like, that's what Buddha told us.
Yeah.
And the other thing that you're also saying, and I say this all the time, you know, equity is not a give, it's a get. It's beneficial when there is equity.
Yeah.
But really what you're saying is you're trying to teach the spiritual law of abundance. People go their whole lives trying to figure this out. So, you know, no wonder it's not easy.
It's just that narrative of all of a sudden, you know, I'm just starting to hear, you know, that allyship equals that I won't be seen anymore. And I'm like, dudes, I have lived my life fighting to be seen. So what makes you think that the moment I'm in a position of power, that I can actually expand the stages to welcome everybody, that the white voice isn't going to be part of my everybody? I think that a lot of it is really the...
it's like, you ain't going anywhere. Don't worry.
Yeah, don't worry. Like, you're still there. I love white people too.
I see
too.
You.
Like,
I love you. It's all good. Don't fret. You're relinquishing fear. Yeah. It's like, I think at the end of the day, people are afraid. And you got to be like, don't be afraid. It's going to be okay.
That's so good. Yeah.
You're going to see some people of color, but it doesn't mean that you don't have a place here. It's all good. You know?
Yeah. It's not the Hunger Games, my friend.
Yeah, this ain't Hunger Games. There's abundance. There's infinite possibilities. Don't you fret. You know? Don't you fret. It's hard. But you know, this is why we need people like, I think, like you speaking out, you know, we need artistic kind of voices to like let people know that, hey, it's all good. Everything is okay. Don't be afraid. Yeah. It's so crazy. So we've been talking for 40 minutes and wow, you just really have so much going on and in you. What's next for you?
What's next? I don't know, Ali Moman. Like, you gotta, you know, like, I feel like I'm ready for the next big thing. I think that Factory has learned a different kind of leadership. But I also want to test. I'm eager to test my leadership, like expand the net, expand the reach. You know, what happens if you give me just a little bit more money, a little bit more support and resources? What, like, I'm often just wondering, like, what is it that I can do? Because I'm always just eager to do more.
Yeah.
And I think I'm really interested in exploring that facet of my leadership self. And to put that to a test. So I don't know, you know, like, I love Factory, been running Factory, and I think that I'm super proud with what I've laid out so far. And this virtual season, and who knows, maybe even next season might still be a virtual with the way that things are looking, right?
No one knows anything, just accept.
No one knows anything, but whoever, you know, when and if I decide to do step down, I think that the next, you know, my successor, I hope I've built enough, like, there's enough gems in there now that the next successor will really be able to have a lot of options to play with. The idea, again, of like in-person productions, but pairing that with a couple of virtual productions with an audio, like, we have purchased equipment that I would never in my tenure as an artistic director would even think to purchase. But now for us, it's like, this is important to invest in. And again, like, I'm investing in different modes of storytelling. And so that the next generation of artistic leaders that comes through this building, this theater company, now have the resources, right, to kind of put stories in different containers that will be accessible for everybody. And I'm really excited at that. And I'm really proud of being able to kind of lay down, you know, if you call it a legacy, that legacy for somebody to really take advantage of and to really create more opportunities. And then for myself, it's, yeah, I think it's like, I often think about what is life after Factory, and I'm kind of up for an adventure. I really don't know. I honestly don't know. And if you're hiring in your political staff, Kelly,
I don't know anything about politics.
I don't know anything about politics, but I can learn. I don't know.
What do you mean? You know communication. You know, you know, you can make something out of nothing. You're probably a really great fundraiser.
Oh my God.
It's so funny. I get a lot of political people being like, what do you know about raising money? I'm like, do you know where I came from? Do you have any idea what we do for a living?
If my last name carries the weight of, like, you know, Philippine politics, sure. But
we'll talk after the podcast. We'll talk after we stop.
You know, you tell me, universe, like, tell me what my next stop is. I'm really open. But, you know, I feel like there's still so much more work to do. And I'm ready to apply it to the next thing that I should be applying it to, you know? So we'll see.
Nina Lee Aquino on the Soft Revolution podcast. Thank you so much, Nina, for joining us and talking to us about Toronto Theatre Factory. Is a legendary room. You know, my sister-in-law, Jackie, who you may know from such places as working at the Shaw Festival, Alley, for her, she used to run the Factory Theatre. And it's been one of those miraculous spaces in Toronto that has really been, like, part of why Toronto has such an amazing cultural reputation is places like the Factory existing in downtown, you know, in the middle of a semi-industrialized area that has now sort of gentrified around it and become the heart, really, of the downtown core. Yeah, but when the Factory was there, the reason they called it the Factory was because there was nothing but factories around it. Wow. You know, there weren't lofts, there weren't buildings, and it was all built on that incredible spirit that came about in the 70s and 80s in Toronto of starting theaters like Pastor Mirai and Tarragon, which are all still going. And that's why it pains me to think that that incredible system of not-for-profit theaters that has turned out so many new plays and platformed so many great artists over the years won't get the support it needs in the face of, you know, institutions that are much larger than those being supported. That's my hope, is that somehow we find a way to distribute what money we're getting from the arts, not just to places like Stratford and Shaw. I'm glad they're getting money as well because they employ tons of people, but to places that keep cities having the personality and the vibrancy that make them worth living in. And Factory is one of those places. So yeah, we can't stop fighting. I really, you know, you guys can be nice. I'll keep being an asshole and we'll get it done together. How does that sound? How does that sound, it. Curtis? Curtis, you be nice. I'll be a dick and we'll get this done. All right.
Okay. Listen. Ariana Revnik just messaged me. Ariana Revnik was, she was on the podcast, student from Calgary. And she just wrote to say, again, to me, to you, which is the best. This is my life now. On our first day of high school, during my first drama class at Western, Caitlin Galishin Lowe, which was her teacher, is her teacher, played Your Ex-Lover Is Dead.
Yeah, listen to that episode, by the way, guys. Yeah, that's great. a great episode. Yeah, it's way back at the beginning of the pod. But these are people doing wonderful work in high schools, making great theater. So sorry, continue, Ali.
Yeah, so Caitlin played Your Ex-Lover Is Dead. And ever since, when there's nothing left to burn, you have to set yourself on fire, has stuck with me. I've heard its meaning ties back to Torkel's dad, but otherwise I can't find any info on its origin as a phrase or quote. I'm wondering if there's anything Torkel could tell me about it before I decide to make it my yearbook quote.
good choice. I can tell you that. Look. I used to write that on my arm for years. Before we used it as an album title, I used to write Set Yourself on Fire all the time on my arm. And what it means to me is that knowing your own weakness is a weapon. Hmm. Your weakness is a weapon. That which is weakest in you is that which is most true and most beautiful. It's unassailable. If you accept that about you, which is not good, which is not strong enough, which is not brave enough, if you love that part of who you are unbeatable. And that very often, what looks like loss is in fact a victory. Very often, what it takes to reach some level of truth for yourself is about sacrificing the illusions you have about yourself and about the things around you. So for me, Set Yourself on Fire kind of should finish with the phrase, so some bastard doesn't set you on fire first.
There
will always be people trying to point out your flaws. If you own those flaws and celebrate those flaws and make those flaws a part of who you are and recognize your beauty within them, and burn bright, then even if you lose, you will be beautiful and people will see you burn. And as an artist, I'm not here to win. I'm here to burn. I'm here to be beautiful. And so I set myself on fire whenever I can. That's what it means to me.
Damn.
Yeah.
All right.
I've had a lot of interviews to think about that answer. So thank you for that softball you just pitched at me, Ali. I was really hoping it wasn't something I didn't know anything about.
It's going to be this. Hey, I have a tweet from when you were 17, Torque.
I have Justin Trudeau on the line. Why are you such an asshole? Okay. Are we done?
No, we have art picks.
Art picks. What's your art pick this week, Ali?
I was going to pick an alternative artist called Dijon. His name is Dijon, and he spreads beautifully
like the mustard.
But he's amazing. He's like a combination of like Prince mixed with like Bon Iver mixed with like it's just wild stuff. So he's really great. But we're going to play a song from Dylan, Field Guide, The Way It Would Be, because this is what we do here at Soft Revolution. You write us, we platform you.
That's all it takes, people. Just write us a letter and we will promote your art, okay?
Man.
Great.
What you
got? Let's listen to some Field Guide. I also have music, but I'm just going to recommend it and people can go find it on their own. There's a new band from Britain called Dry Cleaning who just put out an album called New Long Leg. And I have a particular penchant for grumpy English people talking over rock and roll beats. If you do, this is one of the best of its kind. It's a really delightfully strange, sort of surreal post-punk record. There's no singing on it. There's just talking. but for some reason, it's unbelievably catchy and sort of lighthearted and absurd. And I find that at this moment of all these piercing, sort of scalding truths that we wake up to every day, that these raw numbers that are defining our lives. This album has been a really pleasant, sort of silly, strange, trippy diversion. So if you're into that kind of thing, go check it out. It's called New Long Leg, and the band is called Dry Cleaning. But we're going to go out on our friend Dylan and his fantastic project Field Guide, which apparently you can find all over Spotify. So go check it out. This is Field Guide on Soft Revolution. Please stay safe out there, everybody. We are going to get to the other side of this. It feels really, really difficult right now. It feels really scary, but we're going to get there. And when we get there, they're going to need art. So let's get ourselves ready to tell the story of our lives and tell the story of everyone else's and sit in a field somewhere and cry and move past this shit. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, and we'll see you next week. Love you, Allie.
Love you, bro.
We probably spend Sunday afternoons in thrift stores. We'll drive to the middle of nowhere and make out in the back of your car. No, I know it's all a dream, and you are not in love with me. Sometimes it's nice to think about the way it would be. 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 To be completely honest, this is nothing new. It's been about a year of me falling for you. And honestly, I don't know what to do, so I'm just hanging on. In my experience, this is a rare thing. You meet somebody at a time you weren't expecting. When I looked you in the eye, I knew if timing was different, we'd have given it a try. And though I know that it's all a dream, you are not in love with me. Oh, but sometimes it can be nice to think about the way it would be. 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 Oh, for the record, I'm not trying to win you over or change your mind. I just want you to be as happy as you can be. It's all a dream, and you are not in love with me. But sometimes it can be nice to think about the way it would be. About the way it would be. About the way it would be. About the way it would be.